I'm a living example of about who you know, but it's about who know you and what do they know you for. And so folks would say, hey, let's get Jeff. I was seeing Jeff. He did some really good plans and did this and did that. And so that's what you want to do at the end of the day. But take the job nobody wants and turn it into a job that everybody wants.
Welcome to CT Strategies Unpacked, a podcast that explores insider perspectives of global trade, customs, and border management. In this leadership series, we talk to current and former trade professionals to get a layer deeper than regulation and enforcement. In today's episode, we're talking to Jeff Baldwin, president of Baldwin Liaison Consulting and former CBP operations executive. With over 39 years of federal service with CBP and its predecessor agency, Jeff has directed law enforcement operations and the development of critical infrastructure at leading ports. Today, we will explore his path to success and the significant moments that led him there. Recorded live on July 22nd, 2022, this is the sixth podcast in the CTS Meet the Team series.
Good morning, everyone. This is our latest installment of CTS Unpacked, where we meet our team. Today, we got a special guest, an old friend of mine, Jeff Baldwin. Jeff and I have known each other for several years. And as we've had the opportunity to do on some of our podcasts, we try to take the opportunity to showcase one of the team members, talk about their career path, maybe kind of peel some layers of the onion back on some of the lessons learned in leadership and in life. And then obviously talk about some of the projects that we're working on here. So without further ado, Jeff, I know I've known you for a long time, and maybe I'll get a chance to share that later in the call. But tell us a little bit about yourself and your career with CBP.
Sure. Good morning to you. And thank you for the opportunity to be here, Mr. McCoyett. As you said, we've known each other for quite some time throughout CBP, and it has been both a joy and a pleasure. We always consider CBP folks to be family. And I think that is truly one of those things that we exemplify. I started early on, probably in the 70s, after serving in the Marine Corps and then going to school, Temple University in Philadelphia, where I was born and raised. I started working for Customs in Philadelphia early on. I started as a GS2. I said, I'm not even sure if they still have GS2s today.
I started the GS5, and I thought I was starting at the bottom of the ladder. I didn't realize the ladder went lower than GS5.
But I was, in all honesty, I was a student trainee at the time, so I suspect that may have been part of it. But I started there, and I started in Philadelphia and got all of my training in customs, which Philly was both a seaport operation and an airport operation and the mail facility. So there were a number of operations that we had a chance to work. And then a few years later in the 80s, I took a temporary detail assignment down to Miami, Florida. They sent me down to Miami, Florida in the winter. And so needless to say, you know, being a kid from Philadelphia going down to Miami in the winter when the sun was shining, the palm trees are out and the beach was sparkling, the temporary assignment turned into a permanent assignment. And I stayed in.
Yeah, Miami has that effect on people.
It really, really did. Plus, the work was just so interesting. When I went in the 80s, it was during sort of the drug wars and the cocaine cowboys and some of those other operations. So there was always interesting work in terms of making seizures. And I was on a contraband enforcement team making seizures or whether working at the airport or the seaport. And so you really got to delve into the true meaning of the customs mission in Miami. And so I worked my way through the ranks, and Miami was there probably close to about 16 years. So started as an officer, supervisor, chief, director of the SET team, spent time temporary assignments as a supervisory import specialist, was the director of the fines, penalties, and forfeiture section, and the director of the contraband enforcement team, port director at Miami Seaport. And later in my career, came back to be a port director at Miami International Airport. From there, I went to become the port director in Savannah, Georgia, director of field operations in North Florida, out of Tampa for all of North Florida operations. Came over to be the director of field operations in Houston, and then served as an executive director for all the field operations out of headquarters on a temporary assignment. And then after that was retirement there, and then started my own consulting business.
So you and I met when you were the DFO, the field office director for Houston. And at that point in my career, I was competing for a GS-15 and Customs and Border Protection at the time. They started at what we thought was a new class called the CEP Leadership Institute, and you volunteered to be one of the executive mentors for that group. If memory serves, were you in the Customs Leadership Institute before that?
I was. I was actually in the first class with Commissioner Ray Kelly. Initiated it, and I was actually one of a few people who were the architects of putting the class together, and then we were in the class together in the first inaugural class back in 2000. And so from that, we were asked to, some of us were asked to come back and serve as mentors for future classes since we had built it and seen it. So it was a great opportunity to be able to watch
Absolutely.
And prepare some of the future leaders for the organization. Mm-hmm. And so some of those today I still see that are in position and key mm-hmm. positions in the organization.
Right. And I'm sure, I mean, I saw it. I saw it because a lot of our mentors came in the original CLI class, yourself, Robert Gomez, a couple others. And so from talking to you, and then that I took that class in the mid-2000s, I guess right around 2008, 2010, more or less. Now, 12 years later, most of the folks that were in that first class for CBPLI, which is the next iteration of the class that you took, they all went on to be significant, you know, leaders in the organization. I mean, I think it was a good investment in time and money and resources by CBP to put together that class. And I think the selection process they used, you know, did exactly what they wanted to do, because that became, much like your class, our class also became kind of like a who's who later on in CBP. But from looking at your career, very quickly, I see a strong, you know, operational line where, you know, you're doing the contraband enforcement team and you're doing a lot of operations. But there's a couple of outliers out there, like FPNF and things of that nature. How did you end up going from, you know, being such a strong, you know, operational guy to being out here and doing the administrative and more support related positions?
Well, I think part of it was just my inquisitive nature of wanting to do other parts of operations and to learn as much as I can to prepare myself for the future, but also having a good mentor and a port director in Miami who also sort of saw in me the opportunity of wanting to do some different things and helping me to prepare myself. It was kind of like being thrown into the deep end of a pool and being told to swim when you're in the beginning, when your whole career has been sort of evolved around inspections. And now they say, well, you're now in charge of the fines, penalties, or forfeitures, or the supervisory import specialist. I often tell people the first day when I worked in fines and penalties, I got a call from the courts saying, do you know that you're in contempt of court? And I'm like, yes, I'm the FPNF director, but I have no idea what you're talking about. But first day in office, well, you're in contempt of court because you were supposed to return property to its rightful owner by noon today, and it has not been returned. It was a court order. And I said, well, I will get on it right away. And so that was sort of that whole being thrown in the deep end. And when I went back to the office, I found out that, yeah, one of the specialists had it, and it was just in the pile of mm-hmm. work that they were doing. And so needless to say, one of the first orders of business for me was to prioritize what we had in our office and to ensure that any of those items were being taken care of. So that was my first exposure. But it was one of those things that you carry on from operation to operation. So I always prioritized wherever I went in terms of work, whether professionally or personally.
Okay, so you mentioned a couple of things that I want to come back to. But first, just a comment. I mean, talk about, you know, getting, you know, thrown into the deep end. I mean, just for that to be in a different job and the first day on your job to get a call like that, I mean, it must have been intimidating, but also frustrating. I mean, did you at least for a second there think, what did I get myself into, or how did, or maybe you thinking, I think someone snookered me or something. How am I, this is my first day and walking into something like this.
Yeah, of course, you know, initially when you get thrown in the deep end, there's the shock and awe. And then you start to realize that what do I need to do to survive? What do I need to do to make sure I can make this work? What am I responsible for? What am I accountable for? What are others responsible and accountable for? And how do they all sort of fit together? I mean, you know from your work also that whenever we see something or took something, we just turned it over and we were done. But then there's a whole another line of processing that gets taken care of, from the custody standpoint to the destruction standpoint to and the whole in between. How do you secure it in between? And so you become responsible for those. And I think, you know, it was one of those things, because it was early on, that I really had to look operational, and one of those things that sort of stick with you to whatever operation you went to. What am I responsible for? What am I accountable for? What are others responsible for? What are others accountable for? And how do they all fit that together? And I still use that same sort of methodology when I'm doing consulting work for the businesses or governments or something. How do you get that all sort of to come together?
That's very interesting. So you mentioned a couple other things too that I want to spend some time on. One of which was, you said, and the term you used was, I was trying to prepare myself. And the other one is that this port director of yours picked you and started kind of took an interest in you, which I guess in retrospect I would call was either formal or informal mentoring that she was providing to you. You haven't been one of my mentors over the years, even after we both left CBP. Is it safe to say that the mentoring is something that is important to you because you were exposed to it earlier in your career?
Absolutely. It's right up there in the top three of my list. I understood how important it was that I got mentored, and it was one of the reasons why I always wanted to make sure that I gave back and mentor. It's no sense blazing a trail if you don't bring others along the trail with you. And so, you know, anytime I had opportunity to do that. But at the time, as you mentioned, it wasn't a formal mentoring sense. It was more informal. And I didn't realize, here's the key, I wasn't even realizing I was being mentored at the time. I came in for a meeting one time and I got asked an operational question, and I did not have the numbers and all of the details. I had all of the facts, but I didn't have all of the details. And those are different. And so I was told to come back the next morning at 7 o'clock and have the information. I came back at 6:30 and sat there. And when the person came into the office, they said, come on in. And I came in, I was ready. I was full of details. And they said, you get the answer? And I said, yes. And it is. And they said, I don't want to know. It wasn't about the answer. It was about being prepared. And I'm thinking, I stayed up all night studying for this, and you don't even want to know what to ask. And I was dismissed just like that. Like,
right.
5 to 10 minutes. It was not about the answer. It was about you preparing yourself for questions that are going to come up. And from then on, instead of just preparing for what I want to say, I prepare myself for what are they going to ask me.
And okay, so quick. Go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to
interrupt. No, that's fine. So I prepare for what they're going to ask. So I always say to myself, what are they going to ask? Or have somebody else tell me, what would you ask? And then
that's good.
Prepare, and I give that same advice to folks now.
Yeah, I vaguely recall Rudy Giuliani having a phrase called like relentless preparation or something to that effect, where he described a similar way of being ready for meetings and for engagements and just for things in general. Now, quick question for you. So this was obviously, you know, a critical moment in your career where it was a lesson that you learned about, and even though you were prepared, I think it's safe to say that you, in retrospect, you weren't as prepared as you could have been. Now, did that ever happen to you ever again?
No. No.
And so this was at the beginning of your career, and you went on to do huge, huge things. You went on to be, you know, chief, port director, area port director, field office director, executive director for operations. And those are huge, huge positions where you got millions and millions and millions of dollars that you're responsible for, and thousands and thousands and thousands of employees you're responsible for. And Lord knows how much, you know, legitimate trade and travel is coming through your purview. And I think that's a testament that this lesson that you learned early in your career basically got you prepared to always be prepared from that point forward.
So, well, one of the other things, so when the agency was looking to change personal search standards, so I volunteered to be on the task force to help change the personal search standards. And so a lot of what they do now in the area of personal searches, I was on the architect team to do. The same thing with the disciplinary review board. When they wanted to start a disciplinary review board, I asked to be a part of the architect team to help to establish the DRB. And that is still in. And I say that to say that the constant learning that you have to do to be able to understand it. There were more things that I would see occur in the disciplinary review board when we did cases that I knew I had to go back and make sure that everything was in order in my house. What could I do to ensure that the slip ups that other people had did not occur in my operation? So those are the kind of things, and the same thing with personal search standards.
So that's a good segue to my next question. So you've mentioned this a couple of times now, and I want to tie these two together. So you talk about your inquisitive nature, and that, you know, whether this mentor of yours wanted to challenge you and get you out of your comfort zone, which these are all terms we learned later in our careers, and making you do something that was outside the path that you were on to kind of round you out, or whether it was because you innately were gravitated to the fact that you didn't know something, or that you that there was a piece of knowledge that you wanted to obtain. You referenced it at the beginning of the call that you were preparing yourself. Now, having had the opportunity to interview several leaders that are on the CTS team, and obviously many leaders throughout the course of my career, it's always been really surprising to me that when I talk to them and I ask them about, you know, what was your plan, or how did you plan, or was this part of your plan? And looking at your career, you literally, you know, climbed that ladder and you got to the mountaintop as a senior executive with Customs and Border Protection, and every position that you held, it was a bigger job with bigger responsibility. Now, how much of that path was happenstance or part of your, you know, strategy that you were cultivating?
I would say maybe 80-20. I mean, I was really been blessed in having the opportunity of having positions available. But I did not necessarily jump at every position that was available. I sort of gave myself a 5-year window. My goal was to work in DC in a senior executive level position. And then early on in my career, I had made sure I gave myself a plan. It was like a 5-year plan. So when I was a supervisor, I gave myself 5 years to be a chief. When I was a chief, or 5 years to be an assistant port director or port director. As a port director, 5 years to be a DFO or at least into the SES ranks. And then another 5 years to get to headquarters and then sort of work my way through the ranks there. So it was methodical, but at the same time, it was a blessing because the opportunity came my way to be able to do that. And so, but it didn't from doing other jobs. Like I would volunteer, I was on trade teams and task force and this task force to be able to contribute to the organization as a whole. That was important. Okay? And to continue to mentor people.
Absolutely. And I was a beneficiary of that in a couple of instances. Now you mentioned something that I want to highlight. And I hear this a lot, and I think it's just for the sake of our listeners and our viewers, I just think it's important that we always talk about people use terms that they throw around. Success begets more success and things of that nature. But I'm a big believer in that. Success is the culmination of opportunity and preparation. And I think that you've talked about it several times in our call already about how you were preparing yourself and you were preparing yourself and you were inquisitive. And so you were creating opportunities for yourself in one way or another so that way when it did present itself, you were ready. You were ready for that opportunity and you were willing, ready and willing. And I think that's a huge part of the battle when it comes to, moving, getting ahead in your career is one, being willing to take some risks and to do something that maybe you're not an expert in. But the other is to be constantly seeking out more opportunities just for the sake of being able to learn more or to accomplish, different things. I think that ends up being basically an enabler for having more success down the road. Now, I'm a big planner. And when you talk about the five-year plan, I did a lot of similar things in my career as I was coming up where, and it wasn't much more than a sheet of paper where I would just write down, the year that I started. And every year I put down, my position and my location. And I would kind of do a couple of variations of that where if I went to headquarters, then this would be my path would go this way. If I transfer to the East Coast, my path would go this way. If I transfer, to the northern border, my path would go this way. So I always had a generalized path of how I wanted to continue to advance in my career, but always knowing that there was going to be variations, there was going to be alternatives that they were going to be presented. And so I just wanted to make sure that I was still moving forward, even though I wasn't necessarily on the path that I kind of sketch out for myself. So what I used to always tell my team members is, in every aspect of the operation is if you're failing to plan, you're planning to fail. And I feel like whether or not you've said it, do you feel like that having a plan is this important?
Yes. And I know that's kind of one of the ones that, so the analogy that most people subscribe to is that if you plan to fail, you fail. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. Well, my analogy has always been that if you don't plan, then you're going to be the victim of somebody else's plan. And so it's not a failure on your part. You're going to get victimized by someone who's planning. And so I've always sort of subscribed that I will always make sure I have a plan so that I'm not the victim of somebody else's plan. It's not that I'm not planning because I'm going to fail. I don't want to plan to be somebody else's plan. I want to make sure that my plan is in place. And so always try to make sure that things that I do today, that I am preparing for tomorrow. And so even when I said I looked at those positions, the positions were never about money for me. Mm-hmm. They were about opportunity and accountability, where you would hear some people say, well, I want to be a GS-13 then, and then I want to be a 14, and then I want to be a 15. But what responsibilities do you have? You're not talking about any area or work. And what they do is find themselves in pit holes and pitfalls and just in positions that they really didn't prepare themselves for because they chased the money and not the position. I would tell supervisors often that, you got to understand that when you become a supervisor, you're no longer responsible for yourself, but now you're responsible for a cadre of employees. And in this environment, your employees have guns, badges, access to government vehicles, access to government computers, government credit cards. So you're responsible. You may not be accountable, but you're responsible for those. So if this is really not something that you want to do, don't do it just for the money. Mm-hmm. Work for it. And I've had one or two supervisors in my career after we had our talk say, when you think about that, I really don't want to be responsible for other folks. I wanted to do it. I was hoping to get a bump in pay. And they said, please withdraw my name. And I said, I have more respect for you doing it that way than we have to address it sometime during your probation. And so I got pretty meticulous about preparing things. Even when we did our performance reviews at the beginning of the year, I would tell my supervisor what my goal was at the end of the year. My goal is to make an excellent or outstanding. And if I'm not on track, please let me know. And then I would do my part of making sure that I did what I needed to do. And then when the midterms came around, I would ask, how am I doing? You know what my goal is. I wouldn't sit there and wait for them to tell me, just, you're doing good. You're doing great. Keep up the good work. And then wait. And at the end of the year, get sucker punched with average. And so, you know, some folks may say that's a little, you know, too much, but I say you have to plan or you'll be the victim of someone else's plan. I say that now, both personally and professionally, and to folks that I work with from a strategic consulting perspective. How do we plan so that we don't become the victim of someone else's plan?
Yeah, that's great advice. And I'll be honest with you, even though we met, I would say, at the halfway point of my career, if I would have had some of this advice at the beginning of my career, I mean, my career turned out just fine, but I remember having to have learned a lot of those lessons the hard way, because I wouldn't communicate with my bosses that way. And it wasn't until I became a supervisor that I had employees that would challenge me like that, hey, I want to be rated outstanding. What do I need to show you to be rated outstanding? And I'm like, whoa, hold on a second. That's not the way this works.
Yeah, that's what they would do when I would say that. Whoa, wait a minute. We got something. I said, that's, tell me what I need to do. And I would check in 2 months or 3 months, not wait till the 6 year or the 6 month review process came around. I wanted to know. And from then on, it was all outstanding. And then I broke the system, because then they changed it to pass fail. Mm-hmm. So I always say, I broke it. So they just went.
Yeah, I felt the same way. So I'll echo a comment that you made earlier about, you know, chasing the grade or the pay versus chasing the challenge of the increased accountability and increased responsibility. The way that our pay was structured, it was very odd, because for every promotion that you would get, even though you're not supposed to, it's not supposed to work out this way, just the way it was structured, you end up losing money. And so I there was several times in my career where I got promoted and I would actually make less money. And I remember at one point I was a GS-14 and I had, you know, 400 or so employees, and my counterparts from all the other federal agencies at that level, they're all SESs, you know, and there was people that had 30 employees, they were SESs. And they were, for them, it was mind-boggling. They were, how do you do this as a 14? I tell them, I was like, that's just the structure of our organization. That's since changed for the most part. But for me, I always felt like, you know what? You know, if I didn't want to do this for the money. I want to do it because, you know, the challenge was intriguing to me. And I wanted to get better at just my job. And so having to do some of these assignments, I knew it would make me better in the long run. And so I never really thought about it. And I'm glad I didn't, because I think it would have driven myself crazy. But I do recall several instances where I would have conversations with folks, and they would one of two things. They would challenge me that, hey, I get paid more than you do, and I don't have any of the responsibility that you have. And I'd say, well, I mean, that's your choice. That's not my choice, but that's your choice. So I'm glad to hear that's something that kind of drove you, that innate one desire to challenge yourself. To take on great responsibilities was one of the drivers. So again, you've conquered the mountain. You went out on top as acting XD for operations, and you were a DFO and an SES for many years with CBP. What advice do you have for someone that's at the front end of their career, and when they're looking up at that mountain that you conquered?
The one, take an inventory of what it is. I mean, after you've learned your job, and then look around at some of the other jobs, and then take an inventory of what is it that you want to do. And so if you were 30 years in the future, 35 years in the future, and you were going to retire, what is it that you want to have accomplished? What do you want to be? What role, what position do you want to play in the organization? And then from there, you have to map out what gets you there and give yourself some realistic goals about getting there. Don't worry about what happens to other people and somebody's in the race and they got there faster, and just worry, pace yourself and figure out what's going to get you there. Because it really is about positioning yourself to be able to do that. I'm a living example of, it's really about who you know, but it's about who know you. And what do they know you for?
Exactly.
And so folks would say, hey, you know, let's get Jeff. I was seeing Jeff put together. He did some really good plans and did this and did that. And so that's what you want to do at the end of the day, but making sure that it's what you want to do and what you're good at. Learn. Take the job nobody wants and turn it into a job that everybody wants at the end of the day. That's how you do it. When nobody else volunteers, be the first person to volunteer and mm-hmm. just learn. Jump in the deep end. Sometimes you got to jump. You can't wait to get pushed. Jump.
Yeah, that's great advice. That's great advice. And again, having sat in a lot of the same leadership positions that you did, I recall many conversations I had with folks on the team, and I was always very direct with them, and I would ask them the questions that you're espousing right now. You know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Where do you see yourself in 10 years? You know, what are you doing to get there? And I know that in the course of those conversations, everybody has all the right answers. You know, not everybody, but most folks would say, oh yeah, you know, I want to promote, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do that, I want to do all these things. But then over the course of the year, I would remember these things and I'd say, hey, this person wants to, you know, transfer to HR. So I'd walk over to this person and say, hey, there's a vacancy in HR right now. There's an opportunity for you to go over there and to do, you know, a temporary assignment over there and see if you like it. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I got the days off that I like right now, and I got these other things going on. So it's not right now. It's not really a good time for me. But maybe next year. I'm like, okay, well.
And that's the decision you have to make. But when you are, you know, and some folks, like I said before, and you and I agree that when they say, "Oh, I want to be a GS-14," well, you and I both know there are thousands of GS-14s in the organization in various mm-hmm. capacities, mission support. Mm-hmm. Some fly plane, some drive boats, some are auditors. So when you say, I want to be a GS-14, you're really not saying anything. Mm-hmm. You should be talking about the position that you want to hold within the organization. And I just wanted to kind of segue and say, that is why when I had an opportunity to become an affiliate with CT Strategies, that mm-hmm. I thought it was a no-brainer for me, because I knew the leadership. And I knew the family orientation and how family oriented they were about the people that work with them, because I knew their DNA from being in the organization. I knew that the work they did was comprehensive kind of work, and that they would build an integrated team of people. We all bring different skill sets to the table. Mm-hmm. And so having an opportunity to work with them and playing with them was a no-brainer. So when I had an opportunity to become an affiliate, I'm with them, that was, let's go to work. And so
I
really good, challenging jobs and places that taken me to globally that I've never seen, but I had an opportunity to sit down and strategize with folks on their behalf. And it's really been a pleasure for me to work with them.
100%. I appreciate you doing the plug for CT Strategies, so I didn't have to tee it up for you. That's always something we want to get to during our calls. But I will echo your statements, and I will double down on those for the sake of our listeners and our viewers. I had a conversation with you after I retired, and we actually spoke about CT Strategies, and you encouraged me to have a conversation with them. You know, I came up through the organization with a lot of these individuals that are now part of the affiliate team. So we have our histories, as I did with you. And so that for me was very attractive, to be able to be part of, you know, to continue to be part of this team of folks that I admired, that I worked with. There were a lot of whom were mentors of me for me at different points in my career. And then obviously, you know, Al and Andrew, you know, great guys that, you know, leaders in their own right and you know, great individuals. And it's just a great team to be working with. So thank you for bringing that up.
Now, the conversation always started was, how's your family? How are you? Mm-hmm. We may have an opportunity to work on a project, but the first thing was, how are you? How's your family? And then, would you consider a project?
Absolutely.
You know, and you can't beat that.
Yeah. So it's a pleasure that we're still working together on this team. It's a pleasure that we're talking about mentoring and leadership, even though, you know, because this is something you and I have been talking about for 15 years now. So I love the fact that we're able to continue to do this. But something that we haven't had time to really talk about, just on a lighter note, or just kind of as just for the sake of our audience, I'm fascinated with the whole, you know, cocaine cowboys, narco 80s, that whole thing, you know, all the I've read all the books, I've watched all the documentaries, all the Netflix series, but I wasn't there. You know, I didn't live it. I started my career in the mid 90s, and I was working in the desert, so I have some desert stories. But what are some of the more memorable things, or maybe one or two events that stand out to you during your time in Miami? Because this was at the height of the war on drugs. You know, Nancy Reagan, Ronald Reagan, you know, Miami, South Beach, you name it. I mean, this was really the beginning of what became, you know, the U.S. war on drugs. So you were at the tip of that spear. So tell us something cool about what you did while you were out there.
Well, so a lot of it was just the sheer magnitude of the things that you would see in terms of making seizures. You know, I recall working on a midnight shift, and it was me and one other person, and we were out doing some warehouses and looking at some goods that were going to be exported to South America. And there were some air conditioning units, and we decided, it was about 20 of them, we decided just to open up one and just to take a look. And it was full of cash, money. So we said, well, there's 20 boxes here. Let's just pick another one and open it up and see. And we opened it up, and it was full of money. So we said, well, let's just do one more, and then we'll see. And we opened it up, and it was full of money. And then we said, well, we won't open up anymore. We'll, you know, tape them up, figure it out, and then we'll have to get it back and count it. And it ended up being like $3 million. But wow. You sit there at 3 o'clock in the morning, you in the middle of a warehouse, and you've got $3 million in cash sitting there. And so all of our antennas went up, and we were like, who's going to come and get this money? Did they see us opening this up? And so, you know, you're running around with the whole safety issue and the safety concerns. Or even when I was the director of fines, penalties, and forfeitures, we only thought about the seizures that we were responsible for. And, you know, you had 1,000 pounds of cocaine here, or the $3 million or this, that, and the other. But I had property and boats and strip malls and condo buildings that
wow, I didn't think about that with
drug money. And I'm responsible for the maintenance of these buildings, keeping this property up to standards until it went to auction. And so people just thought about, well, yeah, they see some stuff from the airport and they just put it in the fines and penalties in the seizure warehouse. But you know, I had buildings, and it was just incredible the amount of money back then that was being spent. And so just the last little funny one is that a lot of times when we would find drugs, we would do controlled deliveries and take them out to the properties. And one night we went out to an area, and it was so secluded that it was a warehouse. And there wasn't anywhere to hide, but there was a dumpster in the back. And they said, well, somebody gonna have to get in the dumpster and then radio us if somebody comes and open up the building. And so, you know, I always say, take the job nobody wants.
Literally.
And people would remember that, and they say, following you in there. And so, you know, 2 or 3 hours passed, and I'm like, man, folks, I'm a little hungry. So they would go buy something and throw it in the dumpster with me for me to eat. I'd get some McDonald's or Burger King until we were able to finally effect an arrest for those. But they always tease me about spending the night in the dumpster. So, but.
Wow. You're true to your word in every aspect. Well, Jeff, this has been a great conversation, and like I said, I'm hoping that the viewers and the listeners can get that sense that of camaraderie that we have, the two of us. But our conversations have always gone this way. They've always been easy and smooth. And I was really excited when I joined CTS and we were able to work together again, but when we were able to talk you into participating in the Unpacked series, because I knew our leaders would appreciate it. But even though we've known each other for a long time, I learned a lot about you in this conversation. And I really do wish that I would have met you earlier in my career, because I think that you would have been really beneficial in the early part of my career. And you were instrumental in the second half of my career, and also my second career as a consultant as well. So thank you for taking the time, not only today, but for all the hours I've stolen from you over the years. And then thank you also for all the hours that you've contributed of your time over the past 30, 40 years. I really appreciate it. So I wish you the best of luck in your future projects, and I hope everyone else can enjoy this, and let's stay in touch like we always have.
And it's been my pleasure. And I want to thank Mr. Farley and Mr. Allen for just having the opportunity. As I told them, I'm a CT strategy lifer. I'm here for life. So whatever they need,
that's great.
I will do it. So appreciate you. Best day ever.
Awesome. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this segment of CTS Unpacked. For more information about CT Strategies and our team members, visit our website at ctstrategies.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn to share your thoughts or any ideas you'd like to see in future segments. Stay in the loop by joining our newsletter, where we share the latest CTS updates. Until next time, this is CTS Unpacked.